Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, November 12th, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. We have a Mac expert and a Windows expert in the house to take your calls and questions. We're also going to be talking a bit about eBay, how you can put stuff on eBay, how it works and all that. We have two eBay buyers and sellers online as well today with us. And the phone numbers are, if you'd like to join the conversation, in about 15 minutes, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go right now to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, send us an email, and we'll answer that on air as well. We're here to serve today on Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks, John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning.
Morning, Lyle.
Before we start taking calls from people and answering everybody's dilemmas about computers and technology in general, let's do a little bit of news. I'd like to start with you, Sean.
Good morning. If you are an AOL customer with broadband service, you may want to move.
You won't be soon.
You may want to move from AOL. You may want to move from where you live.
Well, you might want to change your broadband service because AOL is phasing them out.
Phasing broadband out?
Yeah. They've stopped signing new members, and now they're telling existing members or subscribers in 9 southern states that they need to find a new broadband carrier by January 17th.
So it's less America Online and more just America. So wait,
what prompts this?
Are they feeling like, this whole internet thing, what's going on?
Broadband's too fast.
We can't make that kind of content. Huh. That seems pretty strange.
Yeah, well, I guess they're not really disclosing how many customers receive it, but I guess it's pretty expensive from what I understand, and I'm sure AOL's not making money at it.
Right, but okay, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, with high-speed internet being so cheap in the home, it's totally worth it to do it.
It's probably what's going on. They can't compete with other carriers.
But no one's going to buy AOL as an add-on package, right? I mean, you've got your ISP. You don't need AOL.
I don't understand.
Unless you're really attached to your email. I was really proud of my grandfather recently who had AOL for years, but I want broadband and changed his email and, hey, less spam. I mean,
I'm amazed by how many people have broadband and they still have AOL.
Fascinating, huh? Well, AOL does have a really nice service in that you can have it really inexpensive, like $5 a month or something like that.
Right.
And then you're timed for the amount of time you're using the service. But if you're on a broadband line, you're never using it really, except for to check your email. And so it's really
cheap. When I was doing freelance writing and I was going to trade shows and after AMD, I found that AOL was great because I could do a dial-up from anywhere in the United States.
It's a good feature.
And it was great because, for $20 a month, I had connectivity.
Right.
But now with wireless everywhere, it's not so much of a problem anymore.
And is dial-up really connectivity? That's the question.
Yeah, really.
Thank you very much for that story.
So, yeah, if you live in Florida, Kentucky, Georgia, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, North Carolina, or South Carolina, time to move. And the rest of the country soon.
John, you, sir, news story?
I don't have dial-up anymore.
No, we all have high speed.
We all have dial-up, too.
Yeah, it's true.
Most of them offer dial-up for if your broadband goes down.
That's true.
There's been a big shakeup in the supercomputer world. For the last year and a half, the Earth simulator made by NEC in Yokohama, Japan, has been the top computer, the fastest supercomputer in the world.
Known supercomputer, public supercomputer.
Usually, if you're building a supercomputer, you want it known. in public. So
what about like the government? Don't they have secret ones that are better?
The G.I. Joe has Hydra. I'm sure they have.
I think the U.S. government wishes they had computers like these.
The fastest supercomputer made by NEC
was 35.86 teraflops. Trillions?
Oh, you know, it doesn't matter.
Really fast.
It's really fast.
How many teraflops do you need to run Word?
0.001.
Not many. IBM has released a computer called Blue Jean, which is a, as the name implies, it's to help design blue jeans and clothing. Oh, wait. As the name implies, it's to help...
Sean, remind me to smack John later today.
Is that G-E-N-E?
Yes. Okay. It's to help map different gene...
Okay.
Like, you know, looking for problems in the genes. It's roughly twice as fast as the old NEC.
Wait, we just doubled the speed of the supercomputer?
And it's running at about one quarter capacity right now. They're saying within 4 months it'll be at full speed, and we'll be running at close to 300. Roughly 10 times. Yeah.
Wow.
Roughly almost 10 times what the Earth simulator was running.
Levi's must be stoked.
Is there a law, like Moore's law, that, you know, for supercomputers, you know?
I don't think so.
Double capacity.
And then second place has been secured by NASA Ames' new computer, Columbia, which is using SGI equipment, actually.
Really?
And the Blue Jean computer, since it's by IBM, is using PowerPC chips, because IBM makes the PowerPC chips, and Earth's simulator was using the Itanium chip.
Wow, so the fastest computer in the world is running on Mac chips.
No.
No.
A derivative of.
Okay.
PowerPC is, Apple, IBM, and Motorola coalition, but IBM is making the chips.
Sean, why isn't Transmeta making supercomputers? Come on.
Actually, Green Destiny is based on the Transmeta Crusoe processor.
Oh, cool.
I don't see it on here.
And for...
it's not on the list.
For processing power... per wattage used, it's the fastest.
Right.
All right. I've got another statistic similar to that, which is the Virginia Tech has made a supercomputer out of a cluster of G5 computers, Apple's G5 computers. And it's ranking at number 7 right now. It was number 5 until these other two.
How many units?
They don't have the exact count on the site I'm looking at right now. It's I think, I don't know. I have no clue. The cool thing about this, though, Blue Jean computer costs about $100 million, just the computer. The Itanium to NASA Ames computer was $50 million. The NEC Earth simulator in Japan was $350 million. The G5 was $6 million. So speed comparison-wise, this computer is cheaper than anything on the list until you get into the hundreds.
Wow.
And it's running at number 7. So... you know, if you want a really fast cluster, it looks like buying a whole bunch of Apple Macintosh is the way to go right now.
Thank you very much, John, for that
Apple-sided
story. Yeah. Sean, please save us from the Mac world.
Must buy Apple.
Job done. I'm out of here.
Google has become more powerful in the past week. They doubled the number of web pages it indexes from 4 billion to 8 billion. What this means is that you, the Google user, will have more access to more pages and possibly even more matches to your queries.
Speaking of advertisement, what do you mean possibly more matches? You would think. There's twice as many pages out there.
Well, you know...
8 billion pages.
It depends on what you're looking for.
If you don't use Google as your search engine, I want to know why. It's a great
supposedly, search engine. Supposedly, Microsoft has unveiled their latest test version of their new MSM web portal. It's supposed to be a pretty amazing engine.
I can imagine they got money.
You know, I've been using Dogpile lately.
Dogpile...
It uses a bunch of different search engines, including Google, and you know, it's like a meta search engine, and I seem to get more accurate results with it than I have been with Google. Because Google, a lot of people paying a lot of money to be first in line on Google, and they're not always saying which links are sponsored.
Right.
I mean, they do have their sponsored links on the side, but then the first one you see is usually because they paid to be found.
Well, they're colored differently. Those are colored differently, but. Yeah, I know what you mean. It is, and of course, people focus on trying to get good listings on Google. So you might, you know, there might be a story out there that perfectly answers how to fix your problem or whatever it may be that you're looking for, but it's swamped down by all these people that are doing a good job of listing high in Google. And of course, Google tries to fight that kind of placement and tries to do it more intelligently, but it's a battle to some degree. All right. That was Sean's story, right?
Yeah.
Oh, is it my turn?
No, let's go to John.
Okay. Mozilla released Firefox version 1 this Tuesday at 1 a.m.
Yeah, that's big news.
It actually was pretty big news because they've had this thing in beta for, what, 8 years now? Okay, Microsoft, not really. Microsoft, I'm sorry, not Microsoft. Netscape started this in 1998. They did kind of a grassroots open source development of a browser. So this has been going on since 1998. Within the last year or so, it's been
going quick.
Yeah, it's been codenamed Firefox, and it has really brought in some nice features, tabbed browsing, you know, all the things you're used to, you know, built-in search bar. I'm right. Sorry, built-in search feature on the toolbar. All the things we're used to in a better browser. And
it's compliant with a lot of the W3C specs,
yes,
which is nice.
Which means, you know, you can view, what, 90-some-odd percent of the pages out there now.
Right.
And it's finally gone. It's no longer beta. They moved the number on the other side of the decimal point. So it's version 1.0. And it's had 2.5 million downloads since Tuesday.
Not bad.
So it's catching on. They're aiming for a 10% market share. Right now, Internet Explorer owns about 90% of the market share.
95% more like?
Yeah, this article says
so,
90.
So they're pushing for, Firefox pushing for 10%.
Right.
How do they make money? I mean, it's not really a group.
How do they make money?
Very strange.
It's run by Netscape, which is now owned by AOL.
Right. It doesn't matter to me how they make money. It's a great browser. If you're on a Windows machine, it's a necessity. That's what a browser you should use, Firefox. You get it at Mozilla.org. The geeks strongly recommend that. If you're on a Mac, I jump back and forth between Safari and Fire. Sometimes Safari doesn't do what I need to do, so sometimes I go back to Firefox. So great browser.
Microsoft says that it's not afraid, though, because Internet... one of the reasons they're... people might be switching is because Internet Explorer has a lot of security flaws. Microsoft has come back by saying all browsers have security flaws. You just hear about Internet Explorer because it's installed in 90% of the machines, so more often than not, it's exploited. So, I don't know. To me, that says go with Firefox. They also don't agree that just because a competing product has a feature that Internet Explorer doesn't have, i.e. tab browsing, that it's important because they don't think it is.
When you said i.e., then you meant...
Microsoft
says that tab browsing is not important to people?
Yeah. This is from Ben English.
What?
This is from Ben English, Microsoft Security Management Product Manager. He says features such as tab browsing are not important to Internet Explorer users.
See, that is such a... it makes me mad.
That's because people like having 10 browsers open.
Okay, if you don't know tab browsing, you have to enable it in Safari. It comes enabled automatically in Firefox. You can't get it in Internet Explorer without going through third party. And basically what it is instead of having multiple windows splattered all over the place with different websites on it, you have one window and little tabs that have the titles of those web pages across the top. And it's very easy to open a new window or new tab, so it's kind of a window in the background, if you will, that loads while you're reading the current one. It's wonderful.
And
for
it's like having 10 windows open in one window, and you can see at a glance what everything is.
And what status they are unloaded. And
exactly.
Tab browsing is wonderful.
Once you've had it, you can't go back.
That's right. If you're using Safari, go up to Preferences and enable tab browsing. In Firefox, it's enabled automatically, and it's just a great little feature. You can if you're on a Windows machine, right-click on something to open a new tab. And in Mac, you just hold down the Command key. All right. Thank you very much for that. Sean, we'll go ahead and do one more news story. Let me just invite people in now. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We'll take your calls with questions and comments about technology starting now. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Sean, while we're waiting for those calls.
This week was kind of big for the games industry. Microsoft launched Halo 2 for the Xbox. May not care about that, but they sold 125 million worth of Halo 2 in
How many weeks?
In the first day.
What?
Just to give you an idea how this compares to Hollywood.
So in one day they made $125 million in sales. Okay. So The Incredibles, which is out, Pixar's movie, big opening weekend of $70.7 million. So this did what, half again as much?
Wait, that in a weekend?
That was the weekend take.
Let me put it in a little more perspective. Spider-Man, which holds the record for biggest opening weekend in box office history, took in $114 million over 3 days.
Wait, so you're saying that Halo outsold in one day what Spider-Man did in 3 days?
Yes.
That is amazing.
And this explains why the games industry is bigger than Hollywood.
Right. Now, of course, a lot more movies come out than video games.
No, it's bigger. Yeah, it has been.
There's more titles coming out in video games than movies now.
That's kind of amazing.
And this is for Xbox, which is not the most popular game.
PlayStation 2 has a much bigger install base than Xbox.
Wow. So basically everyone that has that system buys the game. Something like that. I mean,
it is the penultimate. You know, I have Halo for Xbox, the very first one, and it's an amazing game. It really is.
Are you gonna
very
buy
immersive.
Are you going to buy number two?
Nah. I'm done with console games. I never play them. My Xbox collects dust.
Yeah.
Pathetic.
It can collect dust over my house.
If
sure,
it must.
Son would love that. Thank you very much, Sean. John, we're going to keep doing news. We'll talk a little bit about eBay. As calls come in and we have time, we're going to go right now to Marina. Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, yeah.
Got a
hi, Tom. How's
there.
It going?
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I teach a class in Linux at MPC, and I'm trying to set up a demonstration on Perl, doing some CGI stuff.
Okay.
And I found some stuff on the internet, and I'm just kind of wondering if you guys can, if you're familiar with this at all. I set up a demo script, like a Hello World thing, and the Internet Explorer, kind of when I try to test it on Internet Explorer, the CGI portion just kind of, it shows the script
the non-executed script.
Yeah, the non-executed portion that's kind of telling what Perl is on the system.
And on that would be on any browser that's going to do that. It's your
so it kind of bloops out of there. And I'm just kind of wondering. I did some tests and I do have Perl on the system and earlier tests.
This system that we're talking about, is this a web server? I mean, what web server is it?
Yeah, it's a web server. It's an Apache.
Okay, and is it running on your local or is it hosted by an ISP?
It's local.
Okay. So what's going on is that web server is not configured to read a .. Are you naming the file .pl?
It's actually it's invoking a .cgi.
Okay. .cgi will work as well. And the first line of the command in that CGI should be pound symbol and then bang or pound and then the path to Perl, basically.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Are you on a Windows machine with this Apache web server?
No,
you're on a Linux machine.
Linux, yeah.
Okay.
It's on a Linux machine. All right,
so
I'm actually viewing it from a Windows machine.
You need to do a couple things. You need to set up your server, your Apache server, to understand that that .cgi is an executable. And one thing you can do first off without doing any configuration stuff in Apache is to make that file executable on the server. Do you know how to do that?
Yeah.
Do a chmod and add executable rights to everybody?
Gosh, you know, I thought I did that. But,
okay. So let's say that's
set it to the PL file.
Yeah, let's say that's done. Go ahead and you can tell that into this machine, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Or SSHN. Tell into the machine, go to that directory, and type dot and a slash and then that file that you want to execute.
Right.
And try running it right there. It will run right there for you if it's set up executable and the path to Perl is correct.
Yeah, actually, that was the demo. The sequence I found on the web kind of talked me through
right.
that.
Does that. Did it run?
It did run.
Okay.
And then I could actually just do the file name by itself, and that was all set up to run like
so
that.
So now you're doing, what you need to do is you need to have Apache understand that that file is an executable, not a text document. And the way to do that is inside Apache's configuration file, which should be in... are you Apache 2 or Apache 1.4?
Actually, I don't know.
Okay. Go to /etc/httpd/, and there is, or maybe it's httpd.conf. There's going to be a configuration file inside that as a directory or that file itself, and there you want to set it up. And it should have comments in there to tell you how to do it.
Cool.
You're going to have to be super user to edit that file.
Right.
Okay?
Cool. No, I've seen some of that. Cool. Thanks a lot.
You bet, Tom.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And Miles has a website.
Oh, yeah.
http://httpd.apache.org/docs-2. Okay, you know what? We're going to put this up on the website.
Yeah, we're going to have to.
So check up on our website. We'll have...
In a little bit.
Yeah, this is dynamic... Oh, it's an Apache tutorial, dynamic content with CGI.
Great.
Apache server.
Great.
Miles,
thanks for listening in and adding to our content. And we're going to go ahead and go to Watsonville. Dave, welcome to GeekSpeak. Dave, welcome. No. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go ahead and go to Helen. I've got you switched around. Dave will be with you in a minute. Helen from Carmel, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. It's a pleasure.
I've got a Mac G4 that's been updated to Panther, and I have quite a lot of graphics software. Yesterday I got an email, and it had 3 GIF files, which I saved on my desktop.
Okay.
And I've used everything I can think of to open those. I can't get them open.
How did you get those GIFs on your system? They're mailed to you? Email. Okay.
So they came as an attachment. I saved them on my desktop.
Okay. And they still have .gif on them?
Yeah.
Okay. I would go ahead and open up Safari.
Okay.
And pull Safari off to the side so that you can see your desktop and you see those files.
Okay.
You can see both at the same time. Grab one of those files with your mouse by clicking down on it and holding onto it and drop it into the Safari window.
Oh, okay.
And that should open it right up.
Really?
Yeah. What's happening is your operating system doesn't understand that that file is a GIF.
Uh-huh.
But the browser should figure it out. I'd bet that those GIFs are actually malformed. There's something wrong with them.
You'll probably get an error.
Yeah, if you get an error, that means that the file is wrong. This file is bad. Yeah.
Why do you think they're wrong?
Because the Mac would probably handle it pretty well and pretty automatically set those things up to open in something. And if it didn't, it means that it didn't understand what they were. You got these in an email that you were expecting to get?
No, but it did come from someone I know, mm-hmm. So I feel okay about that.
What was the was the text of the message that came from the friend that you knew? I mean, the person you knew.
There wasn't a message.
Okay.
This
sounds like it's
it's a spam.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a virus has sent you these from a friend's. It's not necessarily from your friend's email account.
It doesn't sound likely. The reason is he's in Beirut, and sends me lots of stuff in lots of different formats.
Oh,
so
he does. Uh-huh.
I wouldn't suspect anything funny about it.
Well, what was the subject?
If you go into the email and resave the attachments out.
It's
possible that you don't have the whole image. Sometimes when you save it from your email, something can happen and it'll get cut off.
Yeah, it's very possible.
Well, is there a way to open it directly out of my email?
No, you're doing it the right way, I think. I think normally it would show up in your email and it would actually be in the email. So are you using Mail? If that was a GIF file, if that really was a GIF file that was functional, it would just show up right in the image. You wouldn't even have it wouldn't inside the email message.
Oh, you know, okay, I did have one thing in that there wasn't a message, but oh wait, you know what? It was a newspaper article that he had forwarded to me, and it had a photograph in it, and that was in the body of the email, and that was fine. I'm sure who it's from,
it's not a virus. Okay, that means that something happened, and in the transmission, the files got damaged or something.
Uh-huh.
That's very possible. The subject line says something equivalent to some news article or something you need.
Something like that.
Yeah. Because it's very possible that, I mean, it's very easy for someone to spoof that and a virus to get an address book. Let's say a mutual person, friend of both of you, has both of your address book entries in their address book, and they get a virus, and it takes over their machine and starts sending an email. They would send a message to you and pretend like it came from your friend. So it might not even come from your friend's computer in Beirut. It might have came from somebody else's computer that happens to have both your email addresses. Now, but let's put that aside, and let's say that the files, if you get a GIF or a JPEG in Macintosh Mail, it will show it in the body of the message. If it hasn't, then something's wrong. You have to ask your friend to resend it.
Is it just so in the body of the message was what I said, and then there were these four little attachments at the top.
Right. I would go ahead and ask them to send it again if the pictures are important. That's what you're going to need to do.
So GIF is going to be photographs or graphics?
Yes, a GIF is going to be a graphic. It's going to be a low color count graphic. Which means that it won't be like a photograph of a person. It will probably be an icon, a logo, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call. I'm sorry I can't be more helpful.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, now, very patiently from Watsonville, Dave, welcome to Geek Speak.
I'm here.
You're here. You're on air. What's up?
I'm live and ready. I have a three or four-year-old Mac iBook, the ivory-colored one. And it just has a 10-gigabyte hard drive, and it's running out of space.
Okay.
And I was wondering if upgrading that is something I should tackle myself or run away from that.
What are you trying to upgrade, the hard drive?
The hard drive, yeah.
How familiar are you with opening up electronic devices?
I did a hard drive in my Power Mac years ago.
The iBook?
That one was fairly straightforward, though.
Yeah. The iBook, you pretty much have to gut it in order to replace the hard drive.
I did read a little description of it on the internet. It looked fairly complex.
It
ended up with everything everywhere.
Yeah, it is not for the faint of heart. You end up taking off the shell completely. You have to remove. Yeah, you have to basically strip it down to the motherboard before you can get to the hard drive.
Probably worth the money to have someone do that.
It depends on what they're paying. If it's under $100, yeah, it is worth it, because unless you're really familiar and really comfortable with digging in the guts. Although that said, I've done it just because I wanted to try it, and it's doable. It's totally doable.
Did you end up with any extra parts?
None that I needed, apparently. No, it went pretty good. I only had to partially.
You have to make sure you have the proper little screwdrivers and Torx wrenches.
And then you keep track of the screws, because apparently it does matter. There are different length screws, and they do need to go in to the proper slots.
That's the thing that happened to me on a PowerBook recently when opening a PowerBook. You get these different screws. They all look cool when you're unscrewing. They look the same. And then later, after you have them all together, you notice that some are longer and shorter, and you've got problems.
Oh.
So when you pull them out, kind of make notes about where they are. Get all the right, you know, understand where they are. And don't open it up and then go, I'll get back to this in a couple hours or tomorrow or something, because you will never get back together.
All in one sitting.
All in one sitting.
So if you're the adventurous type and you want to take a crack at it,
go for it.
It's a great learning experience. Seriously.
I think I could do that, but my question is how to select the correct hard drive. I wouldn't want to get into that and have the wrong one.
Yeah, that's really important, because you need to make sure you get a hard drive that's thin enough.
Right.
The IBM TravelStar series... Mm-hmm. Is what Max ship with currently, and
TravelStar.
Yeah, those will fit in. Although that's an older style drive.
Yeah, IBM doesn't make hard drives anymore.
Yeah,
Western Digital makes hard drives now.
Oh,
yeah.
So that's probably my biggest question, is which drive to put in there. And I guess if I went to someone, they would make that decision.
You know, Max Sales, which is Otherworld Computing hard drive, Otherworld Computing, they sell laptop hard drives.
Oh, they do.
They're a great place to go. Mac Mall.
Ask any of those guys.
Oh, yeah. Mac Mall.
Yeah. Also, PowerMax in Oregon. I mean, there's a few places that you can go look. You know, go to a Mac retailer and say, hey, I got an Ivory iBook, and I need to upgrade the hard drive. They will sell you one that'll fit in it.
Oh, okay. One extra question. When I'm kind of going to do this at the same time as finally switching more or less my primary operation over to OS 10.
Mm-hmm.
Will I still have old 9.2 still be on when I just kind of do a basic, a new installation of OS 10?
Yes.
Will 9.2 kind of be there in the background?
You can select it to install Classic, yes.
Classic, and that will be
right.
Like 9.2.
But it will ask you to insert the OS 9 CD.
Oh, it will?
Yeah, so make sure you do have an OS 9 CD that came with OS 10.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
I want to comment on the screws.
Yes.
The big ones are standard, typically, and the really thin threaded screws are metric.
In this situation on a Mac, they're probably all metric, but they're different lengths.
Hard drives use standard.
Oh, we're talking about hard drives. That's right.
So
yes.
If you be careful that you don't strip the smaller holes with the standard screw.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
The Friends of the Santa Cruz Public Library sponsors their annual huge book sale on Friday, November 12th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. for friends and members only, and on Saturday, November 13th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the general public. This will be held at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. Information is at 420-5790.
This week in This American Life, I met Kathy LaGlus over 10 years ago when I was an education reporter for NPR's All Things Considered. She was the single best public school teacher I ever watched.
To me, I know you're a sweetheart. I know that.
And she was in a school in Chicago where things were improving dramatically. So I was surprised to hear recently that there was trouble at her school and she was thinking of quitting.
All right, take our seat.
How great schools go bad. This week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and send us an email that way.
KUSP co-sponsors the UC Santa Cruz Arts and Lecture Series and their presentation of Chuck D., best known as the co-founder of the legendary rap group Public Enemy. Chuck D. will speak about the internet music controversy and about his new role as co-host of the morning show on Air America Radio. Chuck D.'s appearance will be on Thursday, November 18th at 8 p.m. at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz. For more information, call 459-2159.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6310. 1-800-520-1101. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, the Geeks this morning. Sean Cleland and John Tracy. We're all standing by waiting for your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers to join the show, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. While we're waiting for calls to come in, John, I'd like to talk a little bit about eBay. And Sean as well, if you have any comments or questions. John, you run a business on eBay, and you do a lot of selling. How many sales do you do per week?
About 100.
Is that how many lists you do?
That's how many lists I do.
Okay.
Wow.
Now, I've gone through the eBay web pages to add a new post item, and it's actually kind of a time-consuming process. And last night, you helped me on a sale.
It's certainly time-consuming with you doing it. Oh, my God.
A lot of reworking. So what do you use instead of just going through the normal web forms to sell?
You mean instead of – there's two ways to do it. You can go up to – well, actually, there's three ways to do it. You can go up to eBay's page and go through it that way. It'll walk you through step by step. And it's great if you're selling one item. It's a one-time thing. You only have one of the item. You're not going to do it that often. It's fine. It's a great way to do it. The second way, if you're selling – something that you have a lot of and you're going to be putting this up over and over again, or if you have several items you're going to be selling, I recommend using a listing application. If you have a Windows machine, eBay provides Turbo Lister. It used to be free. I haven't checked on it recently, but you check, and it should be either free or not too expensive. The one I use, since I have a Macintosh, is made by Blackmagic Software. It's called eLister, and it's about like $30, and you subscribe to it for a six-month period. What these allow you to do is set up a template, if you want, of what you want your auction to look like, put all the information in there, and then if you have something you're going to sell that's similar to that, you can save it as your next auction and then make a few minor changes, and then it allows you to upload it directly to eBay. And you can do everything on this that you do on the normal eBay pages when you're setting stuff up. The third way, like let's say you just inherited an estate full of stuff. You've never used eBay. You've heard it's great, and you want to eBay a bunch of stuff, but you don't want to take the time to do it all yourself. There's a place in Boulder Creek that does this now. There's we had Auction Drop on our show. They're one of the bigger companies that do it. You can take all your stuff to them for a fee. Usually it's a 20 to 30% commission. They will sell all your stuff on eBay. They will take the pictures, get the listing together for you, list it, track the auctions, answer any questions they can, contact you when they have questions that you need to answer. Take care of it all for you.
So the whole service bureau. So
you drop off your junk and they deposit a check in your account?
If it sells.
It sells.
And they're pretty good. They'll research it for you, and they have some pretty knowledgeable people about a lot of different things that they see a lot. So they'll research it, find the best way to write a title. And a title is really important when you're doing an auction, because when someone's searching for something on eBay, what they're going to pick up is the words in your title. Those are your keywords.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So don't worry about making your title semantic. Don't make it a sentence. Put the keywords that are important for your auction. Like if you're selling stamps, put the name of the stamp, the number of the stamp. If it's got a number, maybe put the condition of the stamp.
You know, what's really cool is eBay, if you have books, you can actually enter the ISBN number of the book, and it'll automatically fill in all the information for that book.
That's cool.
I didn't know that.
It's very cool.
So you sell a lot of books online, Sean?
I have sold a few, yeah. I buy more than I sell.
as your library walls protest.
And my wife.
Yeah, right. Well, we're going to go ahead and go to, we're going to take a call from Santa Cruz, probably really close to us. Steve, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hello, you're on air.
Hi. I had a question. I'm thinking about buying a new computer, and there's all the controversy of Mac or PC. I was just wondering, since you guys are geeks, what you guys think is better.
Well, we're geeks, and right now two of us are using Macs, one of us is using a PC. So that's not really
Yeah, but they kind of like their Macs, and I'm a diehard PC person.
Yeah.
Are you a Mac or PC person, personally?
Well, I'm more of a Mac person.
What?
I've kind of used both, but...
So why? So let me ask you why it's up in the air for you. Why isn't it not very clear?
Well, it's just kind of a confusing thing because, right. You see PCs running on... 2 point something gigahertz. And then, I know that there's issues with that Windows has to run through a separate platform or something, whereas the Mac OS is more direct, and so what's less megahertz on a Mac is faster. Yeah. On a PC.
Don't believe all the hype. It's up in the air. There. Okay, what are you going to be doing with this computer?
I want to edit video.
Mm-hmm.
And probably manipulating photos with Photoshop.
Okay, well, you want a laptop or a desktop?
Laptop.
Okay. Sean, as the Windows representative today on GeekSpeak, what machine would he get, what laptop would he get to edit video?
You know, it's funny, I work at a company who makes chips, processors for notebooks, but we make notebooks for really thin and light, you know,
portable.
And it's not what America typically likes to buy, but over in Asia, they love them, you know. But, so these things weigh like a pound,
but you can't
pound and a half, or about half an inch thick. You can't edit video.
But they're really cool.
But the problem with a notebook to edit video is, I mean, it's going to be heavier. It's going to be more like a desktop replacement. Your battery life is not going to be so great. Nice thing is it's going to be portable. You're going to want to look for a nice large screen. A processor in the speed of maybe about 2 gigahertz, I think, would be plenty for editing video. Video card or chipset is going to be more important.
Yeah, make sure you get an ATI, like 9800.
Yeah, ATI Radeon, mobile Radeon chipset would probably be really nice, like the mobile Radeon 9700 chipset.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Now,
memory. A lot of memory.
And for a Windows machine, I know that Sony makes their Vio line, and that can edit video normally.
Oh, yeah, right? Sony's Vio line's nice.
Sony's Vio line is what you're going to want to get. It's going to run you a bit, but it'll definitely allow you to edit video. I have a student in the program that I'm a technical coordinator with, and she's using a Vio, and it's got editing video capabilities.
Yeah.
Okay, on a Mac side.
I'm not done. Okay. And this also talks to Mac, too.
Okay.
Just basic things in the components that you need to think about. At least, I'd say, half a gig of memory. But even more important is hard drive speed. Because a lot of notebook drives, the hard drive speed is only 4,200 RPM. You can find some with 5,400 RPM. For the class that you need to do what you want to do, you probably want to go with something at 7,200 RPM. And that's going to make a big difference for digital video work for you.
Okay. So and that's just how fast it can access the data off the hard drive?
Correct.
And when you're doing importing digital video, it's how fast it can write it to the drive, too.
It's the spindle speed. So the faster the spindle's spinning, the faster you can read data off the drive. And it's even more important, the writing side, because it's not going to be as fast as the reading side. So a 7,200 RPM drive, you'll be able to write the data faster and you won't drop frames.
Are you familiar with any video editing software?
A little Adobe Premiere.
Okay. Well, Premiere is available on both platforms, so you're set on that. I just played with Premiere Elements this last couple of days. I'm trying to get a video edited, and it's a new release that's only on a Windows machine. It's kind of like a light home version of Elements with a DVD burner software.
Premiere.
And I have been unimpressed with it compared to Sonic Foundry's line, which I think is quite much better.
Actually, it's Sony.
Sony Vegas.
5.0, I think it's the latest version. Right. And they have DVD Architect 2.0. They come as a bundle pack.
That's a great application.
I'm very impressed with that.
If you're going to get a laptop on a Windows machine and you haven't bought the software yet for editing video, I would go with that. It's by Sony. It's called Vegas Video. And I think it's 5.0. You said 5.0?
Yeah, Sony Vegas 5.0.
Great application. I like it better than Premiere. Okay, now that's if you're going on the Windows machine. John Macintosh, what kind of Mac can edit video?
Any.
Any Mac laptop right now selling?
Any Mac. Any Mac currently selling can edit video. Out of the box.
And
you can get laptops. In fact, Lyle's new 15-inch aluminum laptop has a DVD burner built into it. I've got this old clunky titanium. I say it's old and clunky now because Lyle got a newer computer. That I've edited video on, and it's great. I love it. It comes built in with iMovie, which is Apple's movie editing suite. Well, it's pretty low-end. It does just basic stuff. But if you're just going to take your film and do basic edits, cut editing, it's perfect for that. If you want to do A-B rolls and stuff like that, you can get something more advanced like Premiere, or you can get Apple has Final Cut Express,
which is
their cheap version, and Final Cut, the full version.
Now, if I were to buy personally a laptop, I want it to be portable. First off, what I do is make sure that I really wanted a laptop to edit video on, because it makes more sense to edit video on a desktop machine. But if I wanted to edit video on a laptop, I would be buying a Mac. I think that if you take the costs associated with a Windows machine and the software needed to edit video versus on a Mac, which comes with it, I think Mac's going to come in still a little bit expensive.
And don't forget your time.
Bad. And using a Macintosh operating system is just really quite wonderful.
And it's really seamless right now, especially Sean, if you want to integrate soundtracks and stuff. iMovie works with iTunes, and you just pull the stuff over and drop it in.
Sean, rebuttal, 20 seconds.
I think you guys are blowing smoke out your ears now.
Also, I was looking on Apple's website, and I don't see a whole lot of difference between their iBook they have right now and the PowerBook.
Right, they all have slow processor speeds compared to a Windows machine.
And that does make a difference.
Yeah, it does.
The primary difference between the iBooks and the PowerBooks is components. The PowerBooks tend to be built a little tougher, and they have a little bit better componentry than the iBooks. iBooks are geared more towards the educational expensive market.
The biggest thing with the PowerBook versus the iBook, the iBook, you can't hack up a second external monitor, and it doesn't have a good graphics card compared to the PowerBook.
And if you're going to buy
the iBooks, you can't hook up a separate external?
No, you can hook up a second monitor, an external monitor that has pretty good resolution, but it will be mirroring the same screen that you have.
You can't have a second monitor.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which, when you're doing video editing, you need a lot of real estate.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the PowerBooks, you can do dual monitors.
That's right, dual monitors out of the box. And it's got a good card.
Yeah, you can do
that with.
You can do that with a lot of PC notebooks.
Yeah, most PC notebooks you can do that with.
And the FireWire is going to be, you know, something you'll want to get just for your camera.
Make sure that if you're getting a Windows machine, make sure to get a FireWire enabled. Macs all have it enabled. But the other thing
with the PC, I would look more for the small business type of notebook rather than the consumer-based notebooks. And you can tell when you go to Dell or HP or Sony's website, there's going to be consumer notebooks and they're going to be, you know, small business and business class.
And again, that's because of the componentry used.
It's not only the componentry, but the actual case and the quality of the notebook is much higher for the business notebooks.
And for example, a business notebook might already come with that higher speed hard drive.
It will, most likely.
So that's a good thing.
Okay.
So have fun with your new Mac laptop.
And then also one more question that you maybe can't answer, but...
We can answer it. I just don't know if it's going to be accurate. Go on.
Do you think Mac is going to come out with the G5 PowerBook soon?
Not soon.
There's a lot of issues to resolve. I'd say late 2005 at the earliest.
I'd say if we see one in the next 2 years, I'll be impressed.
It'll be very loud with very large fans.
We have
liquid cooled.
We have some G5s at UCSC where I'm working, and when those things start using that processing power, they start making noise. And the wind flow in there, if they could get it small enough and quiet enough in a laptop, you're still talking about like paper getting sucked into the machine.
Unbelievable.
It's really quite impressive. So I don't think it's going to be soon. If you're waiting for the G5 to be in a laptop, don't.
The problem is you can't put a 50, 60 watt, 70 watt, you know, processor into a notebook.
Yeah.
It's just too hard to cool.
Apple does have other chips on the horizon they're looking at for faster laptops, but probably you will not see the G5. Yeah, like we've been saying, a year minimum, most likely never.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, yeah, because it looks like they upgraded the iBooks, but they're waiting to upgrade the PowerBooks, and they'll probably do another G4.
Yeah.
I would say that the PowerBook would probably have another G4.
I would not be surprised to see a dual processor G4 PowerBook.
Yeah, that probably makes sense. Thank you very much, Steve.
All right, thank you guys.
Thanks for the call.
Boy, we're passionate about our laptops, aren't we?
I don't know. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland and John Tracy. And just to really be clear, if you want to be editing video on a computer, don't get a laptop. It's going to cost you so much more. Get a desktop machine. It's just a better solution.
Yeah.
I've got a really nice AMD-based dual processor desktop machine at home, and I've got a top-of-the-line laptop from Apple. And I would be rather editing video on the PC at home than on the laptop. It's just how it is.
Yep.
It's nicer to have bigger screens. It's nicer to have just everything that it comes with a desktop machine.
If I had to make a choice, I'd throw my notebook in the trash.
But you can't because that's
well,
what you
my
do
notebook's
for
just for you know work. Checking mail and doing work.
But
on
it's pretty nice and convenient. I mean, when it comes down to
my PC. You know, it's
yeah,
I love that thing.
Or the 7 that you have at home running. Kevin from Lompico, my neighborhood. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm getting ready to buy a new computer, a Macintosh desktop G5, and I'm concerned about transferring the authorizations from older versions of the software, especially expensive stuff like Illustrator and Photoshop. I've already run into difficulty upgrading the copy of Photoshop I have on a...
Are you at Photoshop CS now?
No, I'm just running... Photoshop 6 on System 9. So I have System 10 running on another computer,
right.
And that's where I tried to
You won't be able to go up in Photoshop without going to System 10. And I wouldn't put, well, I don't think you can put System 9 on a G5.
Well, I think it still comes
with... You can run it in Classic.
Yeah, it still comes in there. But in any case, what I'm worried about is having a bunch of headaches with updating, getting the software installed. Say I don't want to buy a brand new, fresh version of CS or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. I have to go back to the very first version of Photoshop that I loaded, like Photoshop 5, and then load.
So you bought Photoshop 5 and you've been upgrading since then.
Yeah, right. And a similar problem. The first version of Illustrator I have is 6.
Have you been talking to Adobe when you did this? Have you like communicated with their lines?
No, I haven't. I'm even to make it worse. I'm kind of careless about
the codes.
Sending them their registration and notices when I buy their software. Sometimes I don't get around to it.
That's not that big a deal. I mean, you've got the original disk still, and therefore you've got the original codes. To say that you'd have to, you know, install 5 and then upgrade to 6 and then upgrade to CS, and then 7 rather, and then CS, seems like it would be such a pain.
It is possible that you could have to do that, but you might want to contact Adobe and see, hey, you know what, I've got these upgrades up to this point. Can you send me a CD that has this application on it?
Or a code, basically, for the new application.
Right, so that you don't have to install from scratch.
Yeah, I would recommend doing that.
I would call Adobe and tell them I have these other authorized versions.
And say, how do I get this so I don't have to install all these ones on a G5? And they should help you out.
Okay.
I mean, there's no reason to stop them. They want to sell you the upgrade path. You know, they want to be able to get you the product. They want to take your money. So
that is the only way that the disks themselves and the system will allow it to happen, though, right? I mean,
with what you currently have, that's the only way that you can actually.
That's what I was afraid of.
Because the upgrade is looking for the previously installed version before.
And are there little files in there? As far as I know, there are. There are little authorizations.
In OS9, if you copy your entire preferences folder over, you should be grabbing all of that, all the authentication stuff.
Yeah.
So if you take your preferences folder and dump it into your new one, especially application support and anything that says Adobe, dump all that in there. It should
allow the installation to take place.
Yeah, it really... there's a point at where it won't, where you can recognize if it's been copied to a new hard drive. It's to prevent pirating.
You have to have the application there, too.
Right.
What you can do is just copy all those files over, though. You copy the application over, you copy over the preferences, and then without installing, you know, you still moved it on the machine, it should detect it. The other way to go, you know, when you do get the upgrade for CS, for example, they might be okay with just you having Photoshop 5 and upgrading from 5. It might detect that and go, okay, yeah, this is a newer version. You did have an older version. You have a legal version. Therefore, we'll upgrade you. So it's possible you can skip out those two middle applications.
Okay, but it's kind of up to Adobe to decide whether they want to assist me or not.
That's right.
Time to send them a box of donuts.
Yep. Thank you, Steve, for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye. Take care. All right. We got two more calls. I think that's all we're going to be taking today. We're going to be taking Bruce and Tom. But first, Bruce from Seaside, welcome to Geek Speak. Bruce? Oh, sorry. I've done this again, twice in one day. Bruce, hang in with us. Tom from Bonnie Doon, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi there, geeks. Say, I've been getting some email recently that trying to do an identity theft on me, I'm pretty sure. People claiming to be things like Citibank, and they want my Social Security number to update records.
Yeah, that's called phishing with a PH, and they definitely are trying to get information from you to steal your identity.
Who should I report that to, if anybody?
Unfortunately, since email is such a viscous fluid right now, there's really nobody you can report it to, unfortunately.
Okay.
You can probably report it to your local police department, and they'll just go, yep, it's phishing, yep, don't answer that.
Understand. The other thing is, my Mac, Power Mac 8500, operates normally, except during startup, you know, when it shows the startup procedure going on the screen.
The dance of the icons.
At that time, it looks like somebody has taken that image and pulled it to the right. There's a big black bar that shows up, and part of the right part of the screen is missing and shows up on the left.
Has it been fine once it boots up? During that process, does it suddenly all shift over and it's all okay?
It's fine once it boots up.
Yeah,
I'd ignore that one, too.
Yeah, what's happening is there's something in the driver... Not in the driver, in the hardware that's telling it to display the information a little bit off, And then once your video drivers kick in, it corrects that, yeah. And then it's fine.
What's probably happening is your monitor is set up to be a certain way and is expecting a certain thing, and then during that screen, it's being given something else. So
one of the things that happens when you first start up a computer is it sends a pulse down the monitor cable to get a response back from the monitor. It's kind of seeing what kind, you know, who's out there.
Yeah.
It gets a reply, and so it's either A, not getting the information back correctly. It probably, if you zap the parameter RAM, it would clear it up, but it's really not worth it.
If it's
displaying normally, it's just, what you know, okay, it's got this quirk. You know, it's like an old car. It makes this noise, but it runs fine.
Oh, okay. Can I ask another quick question?
You just did, but go ahead and ask another, please.
Pardon me?
Go ahead, yes.
Oh, yes. I called in before on this, and the problem is when I try to print a PDF file, I get an image on the screen, a note on the screen that says you don't have enough memory to do this.
Uh-huh. I remember this call. Sure.
I've got 520 megabytes of RAM, and so I think I have 512. I think I've got plenty of RAM. So I wonder, in what application do I not have enough memory?
It's an erroneous error. It's not really that you're out of
error. But I can't print it. Printer won't print it.
Right. What's happening is either the printer drivers are corrupt or your operating system needs help. One of the things that sometimes alleviates this is going into the system folder and then going into the preferences folder and throwing away the Finder preferences. Sometimes that'll help because they can become corrupt, and it's not really what governs memory allocation, but it can mess it up. If that doesn't help, then my guess is you may have to reinstall your operating system, which isn't that big of a deal. You don't have to wipe the hard drive or anything. But just reinstalling.
Won't I lose files if I reinstall the operating system?
Not if you upgrade the operating system. No, if you totally reinstall the operating system, you'll lose all of the old application stuff. It'll make this. It'll make a folder called Previous System Folder, and then you have to do this drag and drop. You know, take the stuff you need from the previous system folder and put it into the new installed system folder. It can be a bit of a pain.
Tom, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for your answers.
Good luck.
And if you're still having problems with it, email geeks@geekspeak. We can work on it from there.
Bruce from Seaside, thanks for holding on with us. What's your question?
Oh, this is Bruce from Seaside.
Hey,
great.
Bruce.
Quick question, mundane thing. Situation is we replaced our old faithful Hewlett-Packard multifunction fax machine with a brand new Super Wazoo Brother fax. Brother multifunction machine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big thing we're discovering now is that the hardware is part of it, but the software for faxing is a major part of it. So the new machine works great, but the software behind it leaves a lot to be desired. And yeah, the Hewlett-Packard stuff did work, and actually worked pretty well. It had a few problems.
So when you say the software leaves to be desired, are you connecting to this thing directly then?
No, connected to a network.
Okay, so when you want to print something, or when you want to fax something, you kind of get a printer driver and you...
Yeah.
And it creates
a
fax.
To a printer driver.
And what's lacking in there that you really want?
What we'd like is a list of numbers faxed, a list of numbers where we've received faxes.
Some logs.
Yeah, logs and some ability to store names and especially store the images. So all we have to do is double-click and we can refax something.
Right, right. That would be a great feature to have in a faxing solution, especially
networking. Well, Hewlett-Packard had it.
Yeah, well, let me say,
a few bugs.
I recently about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, something like that, I decided I really want a laser printer in my house. I want a black and white printer. So I was like, okay, I'll look at HP, and oh, wow, look at this Brother. It looks so much like it. I'll get a Brother printer because it's like half the cost, and it looks like the HP. And I bought it, and it's problematic and horrible, and I hate it. And that's my experience with Brothers. Brother and the line of printing and faxing stuff. That's my one experience. I won't buy another Brother product. Not good. Of course, that's my opinion, just as Lyle Troxell, not as representing KOSP or anything. But that's my thought on it. If you can return it, do so. Spend more. Get an HP. That's my thought. I don't think you're going to find a good software solution for that printer from anybody but Brother, and I don't rely that Brother's going to be able to produce that.
Yeah, I'd be surprised too.
Thank you very much for the call.
Sorry
we didn't have a better answer for you.
Okay, what does fax software do exactly? Does it keep logs and stuff?
Well, it can, only if it's written in. It's probably not.
It can decoding over the actual functionality of it. It can allow you to set up automated faxing and
A good software package will go, you know, we'll just log all this and we'll keep all this somewhere and then we can see where people are going. But it's very possible to make a software solution that you can sell that doesn't have the features that
there might be third-party fax software out there that'll work.
Yeah, that's basically what we were looking at.
Yeah.
Somebody had used things like WinFax.
WinFax.
Fax Pro. When you're dealing with multiple users, multiple machines doing it, your log's going to be individuals probably. But
We can live with that.
Well, that might be your way to go, then. I don't know a good solution. I don't think the geeks here know a good one.
Yeah, because my second question...
I'm actually out of time. I can't have you ask another question. You can email us if you'd like, geeks@speak.org.
Okay.
Thank you, Bruce, for the call.
You're welcome.
Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The geeks today... Sean Cleveland and John Tracy, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Yep, thank you, Lyle.
John, I want to make a special thanks for helping me out last night. And in general, Sean, thanks for being here today.
Yeah.
I know that's really hard for you to get out of work to get here, and I appreciate you being here, both of you. Miles, we missed you. Other geeks in New York and San Francisco, we always miss you guys. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you for participating in GeekSpeak, Maggie, and helping us out every week. To those of you that called in with questions and comments, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us blabbing. And who really wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KDBH, San Otto, or on the web at kusp.org. Next week, we'll be here, like we are every week, 10 o'clock on Fridays. Coming up next is Open Road, but first an NPR break. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The sound of a cleric as Yasser Arafat's coffin was carried to an Egyptian military mosque to begin prayer for the dead. The military funeral for the late Palestinian